Men during one of the subsequent repeats. Annie's days at Cabrini Green were long. At home, Rix might fool around and wrestle with her children. She loved the professional wrestlers Dick the Bruiser and Baron von Raschke, and Rix and her children would put one another in headlocks and deliver flying elbow smashes. Then many nights she'd head out for a marathon walk. She'd leave the house, maybe not to return for hours, venturing off to Kmart or grocery stores miles away. She'd wander by the lake, or she'd retrace her path the first time she came to Cabrini Green, hiking the trail back to the west side, visiting with one family member or another still living there. "Mama, you need to stay in the house sometime," Kenosha or Latasha or Ernestine might say to her. "Who are you talking to? You're not my mama," Rix would answer in mock anger. Other nights, Rix would stay home and barbecue on the ramp, neighbors' children asking if they could have a plate. "Of course," she would tell them, just as soon as she fed her own kids. "We all got along like one big family," Rix liked to say. The refrain, repeated often by Cabrini Green residents, was hard to comprehend for outsiders. But neighbors who were like family also hurt one another. Shootings sometimes started while Annie had her after-school classes on the blacktop, and she'd make the children lie flat, herding them in twos and threes back inside the building. Rix helped her sister get an apartment on the same floor as her, and one day she was visiting when they heard gunshots. Two boys had fired into Annie's apartment window from the open-air walkway. Her son, Raquan, was a toddler at the time, and he was playing by the elevators with Kenosha and another girl when it happened. Kenosha huddled the little ones into a corner so they didn't get hurt. But Annie's nephew, who was in his 20s, was inside the apartment, and she found him splayed on the ground, his body outlined in blood and glass. Two shots from two different guns had entered his stomach. The paramedics wouldn't come at first. They didn't think it safe. When her nephew was finally taken to the hospital, he died twice. Both times his heart stopped and he was jolted back to life. "God wouldn't let him die," Rix would say. She knew the shooters, along with their brothers and aunts and cousins, and had heard they were jealous of her nephew because he had a job and a new Chevy. One of the gunmen was later shot himself, in an unrelated incident, and he was paralyzed from the waist down. Rix would see his family carting him around in a wheelchair. "I didn't care about the shooting after a while, because I got used to the shooting," Rix would say. "I fear no man, no woman. I fear only God." Fear is what brought Bernard Rose to Cabrini Green. A Londoner, he wrote and directed the 1992 horror movie Candyman, adapting the script from a Clive Barker short story that takes place at a Liverpool public housing estate. When Rose arrived in Chicago, unsure where in the city to set his movie, the guys at the municipal film office told him they knew the place. But they said it was impossible to go there without a police escort. Security detail in tow, Rose roamed one of the Cabrini high-rises. He saw murky stairwells, the caves of apartments blackened by fires, entire floors sealed off and abandoned. There was something obviously spooky about that, he recalled. He understood that dangerous things happened there, but he also spent time with people like the Rixes, families who were eating dinner, doing homework, and watching television. It felt, too, like everyday life. The fear around Cabrini was irrational, Rose concluded. It colored every thought people had about the place, blotting out all else, which, for Candyman, at least, was perfect. Horror is all about the uncertainty between what's actual and imagined when the danger can't be seen. In the instant before the anticipated attack, in the shadows of the unknown, terror requires that stories of menace flood the blank spaces of the mind. "The old dark house on the hill has always been the standard setting of horror," Rose explained. "But it seemed to me that the big public housing project was the new venue of terror." Helen, the protagonist of Rose's movie, is a white graduate student in Chicago researching urban legends. She is looking into the myth of the Candyman, a hook-handed apparition who appears when his name is uttered 5 times. A black cleaning woman at the university, overhearing one of Helen's interviews, says she's from the South Side, not the near North Side, but she has a friend who has a cousin who's from Cabrini Green, and she says everyone there is scared of the Candyman once it gets dark. This supernatural murderer is rumored to keep a lair inside a block of vacant high-rise apartments. In a film about the hazy boundaries between myth and reality, the fourth-hand information is appropriately vague. It's enough, though, to send Helen to newspaper archives, where she finds reports of other violent crimes at Cabrini Green attributed to the phantasm, and then into one of the towers. Helen comes to understand, at least in the movie's mortal sense, that the residents tell tales of the monster as a means to comprehend the incomprehensible brutality of their existence. What else could possibly account for the squalor and isolation and violence in which they live? A societal plot to kill off black people? Utter indifference? Self-inflicted suffering? Why not the Candyman? In this way, the Candyman bears little resemblance to the witch who was said to haunt the barrens alongside the Ogden Avenue Bridge during Calvin Cannon's youth. That bit of folklore was evoked to keep children safely inside their homes at the housing development. Candyman was the physical expression of public housing itself as the threat. But Candyman is more about what Cabrini Green means to those who don't live there. Just as urban legends are based on the real fears of those who believe in them, so are certain urban locations able to embody fear. The critic Roger Ebert wrote of Cabrini Green in his 3 out of 4 star review of Candyman in the fall of 1992. The movie's opening images are of Chicago in the colorless gray of early winter as shot from the sky, the contrapuntal piano and organ of Philip Glass's score adding to the ominous effect. The vision of the city is not of a post-industrial dystopia, with burning cars or darkish hordes. This isn't Escape from New York or Colors. Instead, we look down on the repeating tines of skyscrapers, lifeless in their geometric uniformity and drabness. The sprawling towers of Cabrini Green on which the shot ends don't seem like distant outliers. They're nearly indistinguishable from the buildings around them. And that's the point. Wherever you are in the inner city, the danger of Cabrini Green is always in striking distance. The movie references a real-life crime that occurred at Cabrini Green, in which a man was able to enter a neighboring apartment through connected bathroom vanities so cheaply constructed that he simply pushed in the mirrors to create a passageway. Helen goes into the bathroom in her own high-rise condominium and discovers that she, too, can peel off her mirror to enter the apartment behind hers. She learns that her building was originally part of Cabrini Green. The projects are coming from inside the house. Starting in 1990, Chicago's population began to inch up, the first increase in 40 years. The near North Side saw an influx of 4,000 white residents, and the area's median income jumped from a quarter of the city average to twice it during the 1980s. The number of building permits more than quadrupled. Vacant lots that had sold for $30,000 a decade earlier were being snapped up for 5 times that amount. For the young white professionals who chose to live in the city center, the threat of the ghetto was no longer a story of a far-off place. They now inhabited transitioning neighborhoods. Movies such as Martin Scorsese's 1985 comedy After Hours tapped into a phobia held by this new yuppie class. A white office worker finds himself marooned in a yet-to-be-gentrified section of downtown Manhattan. "None of us is safe," one of the endless tabloid headlines blared during the hysteria around the Central Park jogger case. When Jane Byrne moved into Cabrini Green, 6 blocks from her Gold Coast home, she called the housing project a cancer that can spread to every neighborhood in the city. In the spring of 1992, the idea that the violence and disorder of the slums could infect a whole city was being demonstrated elsewhere. As Candyman was being worked on at a Hollywood studio, rioting erupted in Los Angeles following the not guilty verdicts of four police officers caught on video beating the black motorist Rodney King. A sound engineer doing a rough mix of the movie switched between the filmed scenes of Cabrini Green and the televised images of young men running in the streets in South Central. "I'm sorry, I can't do it anymore," he told Rose as he packed up his bags and fled for home. In adapting the Candyman script, Rose created an elaborate backstory for his killer that tapped into numerous racial tropes. As a corporeal being, Candyman was a gifted portrait artist, the son of a slave at the turn of the 19th century whose father earned a fortune after the Civil War by inventing a means to mass-produce shoes. Candyman fell in love with and impregnated one of his subjects, a white woman, and the girl's father hired thugs to lynch him, chasing him to Cabrini Green, which did not exist, sawing off his painting hand before setting him on fire. In his reincarnated form, Candyman appears in the film gaunt-cheeked and dark-skinned, towering in a fur-lined trench coat, possibly as hell-bent on miscegenation — Helen is a dead ringer for his post-bellum beloved — as on murder. In one of the movie's most frightening scenes, Helen investigates a Cabrini Green site where legend has it Candyman disemboweled a victim. The setting is the ultimate urban nightmare: a men's public toilet at a giant inner-city housing project. The toilet's tiny, freestanding building sits alone on the concrete plaza between the red high-rises, like a decaying shrub overshadowed by giant conifers. It is as much on display for thousands of unseen apartment dwellers as it is abandoned. By herself, of course, Helen enters the public bathroom. Spray-painted threats and indecipherable hieroglyphs cover every surface. She snaps away with a camera for her research. In search of answers, she peers into one stall and gags on the smell. She enters another. The toilets are cracked, overrun, coated in grime. At the last stall, she sees graffiti that seems to be a clue. She looks closer, lifting the toilet seat, and recoils. She turns, and a young black man is standing there, filling the small space, blocking her exit. He wears a leather trench coat and holds in his hand a metal hook. Three other guys join him, and one of them grabs Helen from behind. "I hear you're looking for Candyman, bitch," the first one says flatly. "Well, you found him." Then he takes the blunt end of the hook and knocks Helen unconscious. The movie at this moment captures some of the true horror in the casualness and banality of the violence at Cabrini Green. This isn't monster stuff. A guy from the buildings has been appropriating the Candyman myth to prop up his own reputation. Like the shooting into Annie Ricks's apartment that almost killed her nephew twice, it's another routine act amid the city's grinding poverty. The scene ends with the four young men sauntering off, the long camera shot taking in their relaxed stride, the surrounding Cabrini Towers, and the downtown Chicago skyline in the near distance. One afternoon, JR's cousin G-Ball and other Castle crew members noticed a strange white man nearly skipping toward them across the blacktop known as the Killing Field. He appeared as a ghostly apparition, in a tattered old dress, but less Candyman than Casper. The middle-aged man was chubby and balding, wearing thick, cheap glasses, a child's grin smeared across his ruddy face and waving his arms like a semaphore. "Police!" an underage lookout yelled, but anyone with sense could see that this was no cop. What had looked like a dress from a distance was a sort of monk's habit sewn together from dozens of strips of faded blue jeans. The frock was cinched at the waist, and a rosary and a large wooden cross hung from the man's belt. The hobo priest was shouting, "Bud, Buddy, lengthening the last syllable, as if they were all lifelong friends. To their surprise, he gave each of them the gangster disciple's handshake. He was Brother Bill, he said. He was with Catholic Charities, and he would be spending time in the neighborhood. Brother Bill showed up the next day and most days after that. He'd wander between the buildings, sometimes well past midnight, always stopping by 1117 North Cleveland to spend time with the castle crew, asking about their families or small-talking about the bulls or the bears. He never told people to stop selling drugs or to give up their guns. "Hey, Brother Bill," residents would greet him from the ramps and playgrounds. But at the sound of gunfire, whenever there was violence, he hurried to it. He would position himself between the opposing gangs, in the open field and blacktops, or alongside one of the towers or in the lobbies, hoping that his presence might stop the shooting. At the very least, he wanted to give the gang members an excuse to end a fight. Sometimes bullets zipped by so close that he could hear the vacuum of air as they passed, the metallic taste of fear lingering in his mouth. Brother Bill believed that he was protected by God's shield, and he could be harmed only if that protection was lifted. As he neared a gunfight, he said a divine voice would instruct him, "Stand here." It was in those moments, with the surge of adrenaline, the rush of having survived, that he felt a sense of grace. He was fulfilling his purpose, witnessing to save lives. There was a night when he came upon 10 teenagers outside one of the white high-rises on Division Street. They were battering another teen with sticks. Brother Bill picked up the boy, shielding him with his body. One of the stick-wielders said, "Brother Bill, you shouldn't do that." Another of the attackers disagreed. "Nah, that's what he's supposed to do." Years earlier, in 1983, Bill Tomes was deliberating over two job offers, and he dropped into a Ukrainian Catholic church in Chicago to contemplate his options. While he knelt before the altar, he recalled, the light in the church suddenly changed, and the room seemed to spin, as if on an axis. His line of sight had nothing to settle on, save an illuminated portrait of Christ on the wall above him. And then Tomes heard Jesus. "Love, you are forbidden to do anything other than that." The disembodied voice commanded, "I lead, you follow." Tomes had no doubt that the Son of God had spoken to him. He'd experienced a miracle. Even the Catholic Church would later recognize that he'd undergone a genuine locution, a private revelation. But he didn't take himself seriously enough to believe he had a higher calling. He assumed Jesus had made a mistake. Not long after, while lying awake in bed, he felt Christ standing before him, uttering, "You will have me. You will be poor." Bill responded, "Poor? Wow, not too tempting. Yuck, such a deal." Christ went on, "You must forgive everyone everything." Eventually, Bill stopped resisting. He took a vow of poverty and volunteered at one of the poorest parishes in all of Chicago, St. Malachy's. The near West Side parish had over the years catered to Irish families, Italians, and Slavs. It now served the residents of the Henry Horner Homes, a public housing complex of 19 buildings. Alex Kotlowitz's 1991 nonfiction bestseller, There Are No Children Here, was about two brothers, Lafayette and Pharaoh Rivers, living in the Horner Homes with their mother, LeJo, and their siblings. Twice in May, LeJo herded the children into the hallway, where they crouched against the walls to avoid stray bullets, Kotlowitz writes. Pharaoh's stutter worsened, so that he barely talked and stayed mostly by himself. He continued to shake whenever he heard a loud noise. Lafayette told his mother, "Mama, if we don't get away, someone's going to end up dead. I feel it." A great number of the young men Tomes came to know at Horner were members of gangs. He found that he liked talking to them. He'd labor at the parish in the morning and walk the housing development from noon until late at night. Sometimes it was difficult to forgive murderers, people who could fire indiscriminately into a crowd or sell drugs to a young mother at her wit's end. But forgiveness, as Christ had instructed him, was the key to the work. By the mid-80s, Chicago's Cardinal Joseph Bernardine felt the Catholic Church needed to do more to address the violence afflicting the city's parishes, and he asked Tomes to carry out his work with gang members in other parts of the city as well. Tomes had no calling for the priesthood, so he couldn't be a father. Officially, he would be a consultant with Catholic Charities, earning a small stipend, with the church allowing him to go by Brother Bill, a brother in the sense of his union with all people. The place associated most readily with violence in Chicago was Cabrini Green, so that's where Brother Bill was sent. He modeled his habit of stitched denim after the sewn rags worn by St. Francis of Assisi. It looked like the oldest pair of jeans you owned. The denim turned white with wear, tessellated sections gone to holes and then patched, the many parts pieced together like a Frankenstein monster. He could be a holy man or a homeless man. He wore a homemade scapular as well, and his frock had a hood that he never donned, since he felt it looked too Ku Klux Klan. The archdiocese approved the outfit, almost as a kindness to the gang members. Tomes stood out even late at night at public housing. No one would shoot him by accident. The longer Tomes did this work, the less comfortable he was leaving the land. He'd stay at Cabrini Green or Henry Horner or Rockwell Gardens until 2 a.m., waking for morning mass, and then repeating the cycle day after day. Over the years, he saved the programs from each of the funerals he attended as Brother Bill, his stat growing from 10 to 80 to 130. He rarely slept, and he berated himself when someone was hurt in his absence, as if he could have done more. He should have been in the stairwell, in the elevator, on Oak Street, the row houses, Stanton Park, on the blacktop, by the L tracks, in front of the Rock, outside the Lower North Center. J.R. Fleming. The summer of the first Bulls championship in 1991 was miserable with murders. 121 homicides in August alone, the most for any month in Chicago's history, with the official count for the year surpassing 920. More days than not were peaceful at Cabrini, but sniper fire was an especially effective weapon of terror. Employees of Commonwealth Edison refused to do maintenance at a nearby substation, fearing that from inside a cherry picker 50 feet high, they'd appear as targets. Some of the workers weather-sealing the concrete exteriors of the Cabrini high-rises wore bulletproof vests. When J.R. Fleming stepped outside, he would look up to scan the top floors of the towers around him, as if checking for bad weather. If he saw white sheets covering the windows, he figured it was probably safe to hustle across the blacktop. But if he didn't see the sheet, then it was possible someone behind the window was scanning the grounds with a rifle in hand. The thing was, J.R. never knew whether or not he was in the crosshairs, whether the bolt of lightning would suddenly strike. The high-rises forming the south and north boundaries of the killing field fired on the towers lining the east and west borders, and vice versa. In an internal memo, a housing manager at Cabrini told the CHA that snipers in 1157 to 1159 North Cleveland had shot at least 10 people from 500 to 502 West Oak. Every building had some Vietnam veterans, but even untrained guys would go up there to feel the power of aiming the big gun, deciding whether the tiny objects moving below would live or die. I live in a neighborhood I am sure you've heard of, Cabrini Green Housing Development, a longtime tenant named Mrs. Henry Johns wrote in a letter to President George H.W. Bush. The innocent residents of this community cannot walk the streets without fearing for their lives, she explained. I believe in your foreign policy. the United States must take a major role in world affairs. But to be effective in that role, we must also set an example here at home. My solution would be to do what was done in the Persian Gulf. Send in the troops and get rid of the opposition and ammunition. One night, when J.R. and his friends were leaving a liquor store on Larrabee, they heard the percussive blows before they saw the little eruptions on the ground around them. It took a moment for J.R. to realize that someone was shooting at them. They dropped their bottles, fell flat on their chests, and crawled military style on elbows and knees back into the store. Once inside, they patted themselves to check if they'd been hit. They were fine. But now they were trapped. They gave their handguns to the clerk, who stashed them away and did the only thing possible. Called the police. The two cops who showed up cursed J.R. and the guys with him, resentful that they were risking their lives to deal with this nonsense. 30 minutes later, 4 paddy wagons parked front to back to form a wall across Larrabee, and J.R. and his friends crossed the street using the cars as cover. J.R.'s godmother was one of the women who ran his high-rise. Luella Edwards had left Cabrini Green for a time, moving her family to the Harold Ickes home, a public housing development on the south side. But she decided her children were in graver danger there. At least at Cabrini, she knew everyone. As far as the young men hanging out in front of her high-rise, she demanded of them a kind of tax. When J.R. entered the lobby of his building, Edwards would charge out of the tenant council office and say she'd checked the sign-up sheet and he hadn't put in his hours of service. Like all the other guys, he was expected to sweep and mop the ramps, monitor the building's first-floor computer club, and volunteer for Edwards's Take Our Daughters to Work Club. They also chaperoned trips for the children from the building to baseball games or Six Flags Great America. And they were sent across the field to help with Holy Family's Boys in the Hood youth group. There was a weight bench in the 1017 lobby, and J.R. might be waiting to get in his reps when he was ushered into a tenant council meeting, him slouching in the back of the community room, listening abstractedly to the women talk about the city's plans to kick them all off the land at Cabrini. "I had money then. I'm my own boss," J.R. would say. "The end of Cabrini wasn't impacting me." It was Luella Edwards who introduced J.R. to Brother Jim, another lay member of the Catholic Church who joined Brother Bill in walking the city's public housing developments. 20 years younger than Bill Tomes, Jim Fogarty also wore a habit of stitched denim. Tall and athletic, he'd take it off when he joined pickup basketball games, realizing that J.R. and the other young guys wouldn't really try if he had on the robes. He was a student at a Chicago seminary when Bill showed up one day, describing how he stopped gunfire and asking if anyone cared to join him. Later in life, Fogarty would parse more deliberately the line between the real and the symbolic, between meaning and myth. But back then, it looked to him as though Brother Bill had emerged from the pages of Lives of the Saints. Fogarty believed that special people in special places could have divine experiences, and he was eager to see how the Lord worked through this odd man. For the media covering the urban crisis of the 1990s, Brother Bill was irresistible as well. A white man who looked like he'd stepped out of the Middle Ages, claiming that God had sent him to the most infamous public housing project in the country. Time magazine did a feature on him. And in August 1992, a camera crew from the national news show Eye on America followed Brother Bill around Cabrini Green. "Here was the most dangerous patch of blacktop in America," the host intoned, "and Brother Bill was the street gang missionary who had survived some 30 near hits and saved hundreds of lives." The reporters from the program interviewed Luella Edwards, who said her 15-year-old daughter, Laquanda, had begged her to move them away from Cabrini Green. Edwards said she worried every time her children went out to play, but all she could do was pray. With Brother Bill fitted with a microphone, cameras trailed him as he lurked in the shadows, waiting for the gunfire that would set him in motion. A shooting did occur on the land that night, and Tomes ran to it. Sniper fire had struck a girl in the back of the head as she walked on Larrabee near Holy Family. Bending over the victim, with the cameras rolling, Brother Bill looked into the girl's face. It was Laquanda Edwards, interviewed by the news crew only hours before. She had been on her way to the corner store to buy milk. Bill wept over the body. Behind him, J.R. skulked back and forth, set on revenge, a .357 Magnum stuffed into his sweatpants, as Brother Jim talked him down. Brother Jim helped J.R. secure a peddling license, and he found work for many others, although most of the jobs didn't stick. He even offered J.R. a way out of Cabrini Green. A group that included Judge Reinhold, the actor from Beverly Hills Cop and Fast Times at Ridgemont High, bought the film rights to Brother Bill's life. The production faltered, and Brother Jim arranged for J.R. to provide the Hollywood guys with some verite footage of life on the ground at Cabrini. J.R. already owned the video equipment, and he discovered that he loved the process of filming and editing, creating a story out of a thousand stray moments. He'd capture his friends as they gathered in front of their high-rise or crossed Larrabee on their way to the mall or hung out inside Sammy's Red Hots, across from Atrium Village beside the L-tracks. He sometimes stage-managed, ordering everyone back inside the hot dog stand so he could shoot their exits all over again, instructing them to walk more naturally. He started filming young rappers from Cabrini, and suddenly every guy who wanted to show off his rhyming skills was seeking him out for an audition. The team from Hollywood liked what it saw. Brother Jim suggested J.R. do like Preach at the end of Cooley High and quit Cabrini Green for the West Coast movie industry. J.R. had savings from his peddling, and he could ask Reinhold for a starter job in film. It was appealing, the idea of the total reinvention. But J.R. couldn't leave. He told Jim that he already knew all about the Bloods and Crips from what he'd heard in West Coast rap and seen in movies like Colors, Boys in the Hood, and South Central. The L.A. gangs had become as infamous, as much of an urban boogeyman, as Cabrini Green. If J.R. lived out west, he half-joked, he wouldn't be safe wearing any color other than orange. He was less afraid of violence, though, than of the unknown of a new place. He'd rather stick it out with what was familiar, where his friends and family lived. For better and for worse, he'd announce, I am Cabrini Green. 11. Dantrell Davis Way. She was 12, and he was 15, and to Annette seemed somehow better than the other guys stationed in the lobby. Sharper dressed, funnier, finer. That's how she knew it was love. In 1982, Kelvin Davis lived on the west side with his mother, but he showed up each day at Cabrini Green. K-Mac, they called him. There were lots of boys and also men who tried to talk to Annette Freeman. She was a tomboy, short and cute, with close-cropped hair. It was Kelvin, though, who understood her suffering. Annette's father died the previous year, shot dead on the south side. She'd been running away from her mother's apartment in 500 West Oak ever since. Janice Freeman would drink, beat Annette, and then beg forgiveness after sobering up, only to wake Annette later that night with more blows. So Annette left home. It's time to man up, she told herself. She refused to sell her body, choosing to sell weed instead. She got a job selling newspapers, too, hawking them on Chicago Avenue, State, and Michigan, the only girl out there with all the boys. Some nights, Annette slept at her grandmother's house, more than 100 blocks south, but each morning she hopped on the L to come back to her building. Kelvin would be there, and he'd call her the lost child and make her laugh through her pain. Annette was 14 in 1984 when she learned she was pregnant. It seemed to her like the end of the world. Among her friends from the building, She was the first to get pregnant. She was humiliated, her belly sticking out, announcing that she was having sex. So much for manning up. She had to quit the job selling newspapers. "Here I was, a child and homeless and about to have a child of my own," she recalled. She wondered what kind of mother she could possibly be. But Kelvin kept telling her it was going to be all right. "We're going to be okay, Anne," he repeated. They named the baby after two of Kelvin's uncles, Dantrell Tremaine Davis. Annette called him Danny. Annette had been abandoned as a child, left for several years with a woman on the South Side she didn't know. And because she was still a ward of the state, the Department of Children and Family Services wanted her to sign over parental rights. A baby was a burden, no doubt, but she wouldn't give Danny up. No way. She wouldn't even leave him alone with other people. Not after what had happened to her. The two of them went everywhere together. She took him with her to Cabrini, and they would stroll downtown or to the Lincoln Park Zoo or to the beaches on Oak Street and North Avenue. They'd walk to the Milk Duds factory to get candies and wander Old Town, looking in the bike shop and the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum. Kelvin had other children with other girls, but he'd join them sometimes, the three of them like a family. Annette and Danny slept at her grandmother's, or at Kelvin's mother's place, or in the elevator of 500 West Oak. Occasionally, she rode the train with Danny, going from one end of the line to the other until morning. When Annette turned 18 and Danny was 3, she filled out an application for her own apartment at Cabrini Green. She would never forget the day she got it, February 9th, 1989. The unit was on the 6th floor of 502 West Oak. The twin connected to her mother's building, and moving in was her freedom. It was liberation not only from the uncertainty of homelessness, the cold, and strange men, but also from all the naysayers who told her she wouldn't accomplish anything, that she'd probably be dead by age 18 and couldn't take care of a child. Her Uncle Henry, a bus driver, helped her with furniture. An official from Family Services checking on her saw that the apartment was clean, that she was providing for her son, and Annette was granted guardianship over both Dantrell and, for the first time, her own self. Annette made sure Danny played baseball at Cabrini and boxed in the Seward Park Fieldhouse. She never let him miss a day of school. No way would Danny grow up to be in a gang and sell drugs. She sold drugs, but that was to keep Danny in the shoes and clothes she couldn't afford on a public aid check alone. She took one of the rotating shifts outside her building. With so many others needing the work, she barely got any hours. When Dantrell acted up and was sent to a kindergarten for children with behavioral problems, Annette's friends told her she was lucky. She could claim an SSI, Supplemental Security Income, for someone with a disability. "I'm not going to claim shit extra," she said, "because my son is intelligent. He was hard-headed, that's all. He didn't listen to anyone but his mother and father." She rode the bus with him to school each day, making sure he was taken seriously as a student. She lobbied to get him reassigned to a school at Cabrini for first grade. In the spring of that kindergarten year, in 1992, with Dantrell asleep on their couch, Annette left him for a shift outside the building. At 4 a.m., a woman who lived next door heard Dantrell's screams before she smelled the smoke. A man from the building kicked in the door. A cigarette by the couch must have started the fire. An ambulance rushed Dantrell to the emergency room while firefighters put out the blaze and the police located Annette. The burns covered half of Dantrell's body, mostly on his left side, over his stomach and arms and face. His cheeks were polka-dotted in pink where the skin seared, his fingertips hardened like wood. He spent the next few weeks in the hospital, Annette and Kelvin by his side. After the skin grafts, you could see the burns, but they were much less visible. They got another apartment in 502 West Oak. Annette was ordered to take parenting classes. She was happy to do it. She was told she couldn't leave him alone again. She understood. After weeks in the hospital, Dantrell was ready to start first grade at Jenner. That was perfect. The elementary school was right outside their high-rise, not 100 feet from their front door. Although he still couldn't read or print out letters, his new teacher said it would be only a matter of time, and Annie believed him. At the start of the school day, he sat transfixed as the teacher read stories to the class. He won second place in a boxing tournament, and his coach thought his wide smile electric. Annette felt they were doing good. They'd both overcome so much. Dantrell told her all the time that he loved her. He'd repeat it like a song. I love, love, love you. He was only 7, but he had an old soul. He didn't give up on me, even when I gave up on myself, Annette would say. Not my little soldier. Not my best friend. Then on September 13th, a week into the school year, Kelvin Davis died. He was 27, his body discovered in bed at his mother's West Side home. Annette would blame asthma. Official reports stated that he choked in his sleep, the likely result of a drug overdose, either heroin or methadone. His rap sheet was long on petty crimes: possession, assault, shoplifting. He had 9 children total, but Annette said he'd been a good father to Danny, and he was the only man she ever loved. They'd been together 10 years, almost half her life, and the death made her want to drink herself senseless, or die, or hurt other people. She held it together for Danny. I miss him too, she'd tell her son. But it's only us now. In October, a couple of weeks after the funeral, Kelvin's sister dropped by to check on them. The night was cold, and as they walked Dantrell's aunt back to the bus stop, Annette looked down at her son, trudging silently between them, his face twisted in worry. Man, Ma, I don't want to get shot, he said. It was a peculiar thing for him to say. He'd never fretted over the violence before. Their building was Vice Lords, and the towers flanking them were controlled by gangster disciples. When Annette was in high school, she and her friends started their walk to Lincoln Park each morning by counting down before breaking into a sprint, with guys from the surrounding high-rises dropping things on them or streaming outside with golf clubs and giving chase. Annette trained Dantrell from an early age to stay clear of the blacktop, to walk away when fights started. At the sound of a gun blast, he knew to fall on the ground. He knew the drill. She told him not to worry. Don't I always got you, Danny? She said, pulling him into her waist. I'll take care of you. The next morning, October 13th, 1992, was a Tuesday, and Dantrell loafed in his room, watching cartoons while Annette dressed. That wasn't like him. He usually set the pace, beating her to the door. You're not going to school today? Annette teased. He said he wanted to stay home and spend the day with her, but skipping school wasn't part of their plan. When he still didn't budge, she agreed reluctantly to walk him downstairs. They came out of the building, and Annette waited for him to cross the street to Jenner. Several teachers were outside greeting students, parents in shiny yellow vests working as crossing guards. 2 police officers idled in a squad car at the corner. Annette pointed to Danny's friends. There goes Doo-Doo, she told him. But he didn't move. Didn't I tell you to go over by the school? She urged him on with a flick of her hands, irritated in the way parents get when their children are slow to react. Do something, she snapped. I am doing something, Ma. Then the 9 a.m. school bell sounded. A moment later, Annette heard the first of the shots. She dropped to the ground and yelled for Dantrell to do the same. When she looked over, she saw him already on his stomach, and a bit of pride blossomed in her. That's because of his learnings, she told herself. She had prepared him. She was keeping him safe. The shooting stopped, and Annette crawled over to her son. All right, let's get up. Let's go in the building, she said. but he couldn't get up. Bystanders said she screamed, "Please, baby, don't die!" and, "Please come and get my baby! Please hurry!" She didn't remember any of that. A half hour later, at Children's Memorial Hospital, Dantrell Davis was pronounced dead. A bullet had entered the left side of his head. Dantrell Davis was a 782nd person murdered in Chicago in 1992. That was in October, and by year's end, the official count would reach 943. More homicides than in any year in city history except 1974, when Chicago had 970 killings and almost 600,000 more residents. Much of the violence was blamed on gangs and drugs. It was the height of crack addiction, with dealers and buyers and hardcore users congregating in vice districts like Cabrini Green. Dantrell was also the 74th child to be killed that year. He wasn't even singular as far as victims from Jenner Elementary. 3 months earlier, it had been Laquanda Edwards, buying milk on Larrabee Street, struck down by a sniper. In March, second grader Anthony Felton was standing almost exactly where Dantrell died when 13-year-old Rodnell Dennis fired blindly into a crowd and killed the younger boy. There were lots of Dantrell Davises before Dantrell Davis, Dolores Wilson's daughter Cheryl said. It is a trick of fate, the perfect storm of circumstance, that raises any one tragedy into something other than an installment in a city's daily accounting of horrors. The shameful rule is that bystanders are gunned down, boys are shot by police, children murder other children, and what's shocking today elicits no extended public outcry. Dantrell Davis proved to be the rare exception. Dantrell will go down in the history books of this country, Vince Lane, the CHA head, announced to reporters in the days after the shooting. Dantrell has gotten the world's attention. That he became, as the editor of the Sun-Times declared, the symbol that Emmett Till was due in part to the circumstances of his death. He stood only a couple dozen steps from his school's entrance, first thing in the morning, surrounded by teachers and police. He and his mother were side by side. He represented any 7-year-old starting not merely his day, but a lifetime of untold experiences. That he was vulnerable even then captured the growing feeling that the city had finally broken. It had lost its capacity for mercy. Cardinal Joseph Bernardine said that Dantrell's death underscored the social pathology that we have refused to acknowledge. Still, Dantrell's brief life would likely have been forgotten if he had not been from Cabrini Green. Dantrell Davis and Cabrini Green were talked about together as the manifestation of the crisis of inner-city America. In the extended coverage, the media outlets each ran long treatises about the woeful history of the development. "Cabrini Green was born in Little Hell," wrote the Tribune. "The name is still sadly apt." On national news shows, Cabrini Green was Fort Cabrini, compared with Beirut, Sarajevo, and Somalia. "A public housing hellhole of poverty and crime," reported the CBS Evening News. One of the hundreds of newspaper articles on the shooting stated, "Now the very name Cabrini is synonymous with what many people fear most about urban America. Rage and hopelessness spiraling out of control." The reactions made sense, almost, when considering that Dantrell Davis and Candyman were complete contemporaries. On the last night of Dantrell's life, as he walked with his mother and aunt, the horror movie set at Cabrini Green was premiering at the Chicago International Film Festival, just 4 blocks away. On the morning that Dantrell was shot, at roughly the exact same time, 300 officers were raiding Altgeld Gardens, the 190-acre public housing village on the city's southern edge. A young Barack Obama did community organizing there for 3 years in the 1980s, trying to get asbestos removed from the buildings and an after-school program started for teenagers. He found that the absence of any of the social order he'd witnessed in the slums of Jakarta as a child made a place like Altgeld so desperate. Obama wrote in his memoir, "It wasn't as bad as Chicago's high-rise projects yet. The Robert Taylors and Cabrini Greens, with their ink-black stairwells and urine-stained lobbies and random shootings." He was right about the yet. With the closing of the steel mills that were the reason for building Altgeld way out there in the first place, the development's thousands of residents were cut off from both the city and from jobs. It was now part of what was colloquially known as the Wild 100s, the dangerous and depressed three-digit streets of the distant South Side. The officers conducting the early morning raid turned up 20 guns, a small cache of drugs, and portable two-way radios that officials said drug dealers were using to coordinate their operations. 35 people at the development were arrested. But Altgeld, 16 miles from the city center and a world away, was hardly news. When Lane got word of the shooting on the near north side, he sped across town. He knew that Dantrell's death would be a sensation. "It was Cabrini Green," he explained more than two decades later with a cry. "Nobody cared about the other projects. Cabrini sat in the heart of the city. The world knew about Cabrini Green." By the time he arrived, mothers and grandmothers had already collected their children from Jenner. Studentless teachers huddled together in a daze. Dozens of police cars with their whirling blue lights were parked at uneven angles. A traffic jam of news trailers had formed along the streets, while reporters and city officials ran clumsily between buildings with their heads ducked, fearing additional fire. A spent rifle cartridge was found in one of the high-rises facing 500 to 502 West Oak, and 60 officers charged into the building. They determined that the shot likely came from a window in an abandoned 10th-floor apartment in 1157 North Cleveland, about 300 yards from where Dantrell fell. By noon the next day, the police had arrested Anthony Garrett, a 33-year-old lifetime Cabrini resident. Richard M. Daley was 49 and had been mayor for less than 3 years when Dantrell Davis was shot. He had defeated Harold Washington's successor, Eugene Sawyer, in a special election in 1989, and 2 years later was reelected to his first full term. His 63% of the vote in the Democratic primary exceeding even his father's best electoral showing. After 21 years of old man Daley, 5 different mayors ran Chicago in a little over a decade. The younger Daley seemed like a kind of stability, especially after the turmoil of the council wars that beset Washington's mayoralty. And unlike Jane Byrne, who made several racial missteps early in her tenure, Daley appointed minority members to his cabinet and to head many of the city's departments. He formed alliances with leaders in the city's Black and Latino communities, and he became the first mayor to march at the head of the city's gay and lesbian pride parade. Prior to becoming mayor, Daley had served 2 decades as an Illinois state senator and the Cook County state's attorney. But he distanced himself from his father's Democratic machine, whose faithful still blamed him for splitting the white electorate with Byrne in 1983, thus allowing Washington to win office. In the 13 years between the two Mayor Daleys, the party machinery had actually been rendered somewhat obsolete. The Shachtman decrees that were signed into law in entirety in 1983 illegalized much of the patronage system that bartered city and state positions in exchange for political support. By the 1990s, political bonds were sealed not through the doling out of city jobs, but through the dispensing of city contracts. The younger Daley proved adept at the new system, forging ties with Republicans in the suburbs, where many city companies had relocated. He began filling vacancies on the city council with aldermen loyal not to the Democratic organization of Cook County, but to him. He reordered city bureaucracies, made sure the White Sox remained in Chicago, and invested heavily in a resurgent downtown. He also benefited greatly from an improved economy. After 40 years of population declines, a net loss of 837,000 people, Chicago began to add residents again as Daley took office. His was the new gleaming Chicago of Michael Jordan and Oprah and Charlie Trotter. Daley himself would move, in 1993, from the old sod of Bridgeport to the luxury Central Station, a former rail yard just south of the Loop that had been one of the primary targets for redevelopment in the Chicago 21 plan. While Daley had managed the city up to then with a low-key style, he'd yet to show much leadership on the growing problem of violent crime. The number of murders in the city rose each year he'd been in office, 742 in 1989, then 851 in 1990, and 928 in 1991. Throughout his tenure, Daley would be mocked and also praised for his sometimes garbled speech, a sign, trusted aides would say, of his too-fast-for-his-mouth thinking. In a press conference, he denounced drive-by shoot-alongs. At another, he proclaimed, "The more killings and homicides you have, the more havoc it prevents." At the time of Dantrell Davis's murder, Daley was visiting his daughter at Connecticut College, and he didn't gauge the political significance of this death. In a record bloody year, Davis seemed another painful loss, a tragedy, but not an all-hands-on-deck civic emergency, or even cause for a public comment. Jane Byrne figured out early on the space that Cabrini-Green held in the civic psyche, and she turned a shooting spree there into the most prominent political moment of her career. By contrast, Daley's ongoing absence was compared with the schmoozing of Los Angeles's police chief Daryl Gates at a Brentwood cocktail party, as rioters tore their way through his city earlier in the year. The Sun-Times wrote of the Chicago mayor, "This city cried out for leadership last week, and the biggest chair of all was empty." Daley slammed his critics, saying that family was of the utmost importance, reminding more than a few Chicagoans of his father's response to reports that he'd helped the younger Daley and his brothers get lucrative city contracts and court appointments. "If I can't help my sons, then they can kiss my ass," Richard J. Daley had said in 1973. If a man can't put his arms around his sons, then what kind of world are we living in? But rather than return to Chicago after visiting his daughter, Richard M. Daley traveled to Hyannisport, Massachusetts, to join the Kennedys at a golf tournament. With Daley gone, Vince Lane stepped onto the public stage, announcing into a bouquet of microphones that he would do whatever was needed to turn the infamous public housing project into a normal neighborhood. He was ready to send in 1,000 additional state and federal law enforcement officers to sweep every building. The tower from which Dantrell's killer had fired the fatal shot already had an official vacancy rate of over 75%. Lane declared that the building would be permanently closed. "And I don't mean with plywood. I mean with masonry." He called on the National Guard to police Cabrini-Green, demanding that armed troops form a perimeter around the development's 23 towers and all 600 of the row houses. Daley decided it was time to cut short his trip. Lane couldn't be the one making all the pronouncements. The mayor announced a meeting with his advisors for Monday morning, 6 days after Davis's killing. Then the emergency meeting with 20 of his top officials was moved up to Sunday. At the press conference afterward, Daley appeared sunburned. His aides said from activities the mayor did in Chicago, before his golf trip. Daley presented an 11-point plan for Cabrini-Green. He adopted several of Lane's impromptu proposals as part of his own strategy, saying that he would shutter up to 4 Cabrini high-rises and outfit the remaining buildings with metal detectors and one-way turnstiles. He'd place armed guards in the lobbies. His agencies would expedite evictions, putting together a team of lawyers who'd work pro bono to remove drug dealers and gangbangers. The city would pay 270 off-duty officers to sweep every building in the project of weapons, at a cost of upward of $500,000. Adopting the language of the war on drugs, he promised Chicagoans that he would take their city back from gangsters and make it safe for all law-abiding citizens. "We cannot surrender," Daley pledged.